When you attempt to model the figure, forget about the current style. Forget about making a statement. Forget about being cutting edge. Just observe your world carefully and create an image that will convey that world to those who follow. Those are the words of my guest on Profiles, Harold Tuck Langland. Tuck Langland is a sculptor, author, and professor emeritus at Indiana University South Bend, where he taught in the fine arts department for more than 30 years. He designed the statue of Herman B. Wells on the IU Bloomington campus and the sculpture in the fountain outside the Student Activities Center on the IU South Bend campus. Tuck Langland's sculptures are housed in numerous museums, parks, public gardens, colleges, and corporate and private collections around the world, including the Midwest Museum of American Art and the Smithsonian Collection. He's first vice president of the National Sculpture Society, an academician in the National Academy of Art, and the author of two books on sculpture, Practical Sculpture, and From Clay to Bronze, A Studio Guide to Figurative Sculpture. I'm Adam Schwartz. Please join me over the next hour as we get to know sculptor Tuck Langland on this edition of Profiles. Tuck Langland, welcome.
Nice to be here.
How did you get the nickname Tuck?
Just a nickname my parents gave me. My mother did, primarily, when I was a little kid. There are very few people that have that name, but interestingly enough, one of the few others that I ever knew with that name was right here at IU. His name was Austin Caswell, in the music department, a music historian. And he went by the name of Tuck Caswell.
And how did you first become interested in sculpture?
Well, when I was a young lad, you know, living at home, my brother and my father made things, had workbenches in the basement. And I got my own workbench and tools when I was about 5 or 6 years old. I thought everyone had a workbench. Found out later that people would have a few pliers and screwdrivers in the kitchen drawer, and that was it. So I made things. I liked to play with toy soldiers when I was a little boy, and I made forts and things and boats and stuff. Then I went to a boys' military prep school in St. Paul, Minnesota, called St. Paul Academy. And they did not believe in fads and frills like the arts. So we had no arts. We never heard the word Mozart. We never heard the word Michelangelo or Rembrandt or anything like that. They were training us to be, first of all, students at Ivy League schools and then to become stockbrokers and bankers and doctors and lawyers and things like that. So it wasn't until I got out of there and went to the University of Minnesota that I discovered there was another world of art. And I took some art classes, and then in my junior year, first – this is an interesting lesson for students in college because you don't necessarily need to decide too soon. It wasn't until my junior year that I took a sculpture class, and the first day they gave us some clay and a bit of an armature and a model and said, work on that. And I just loved it. I walked out of class the first day and I didn't say to myself, I like sculpture. I didn't say to myself, I think I'll be a sculptor. I was saying to myself, I am a sculptor. In that first quarter, we were in the quarter system. We're supposed to produce one head in clay and cast it in plaster and finish it. And that challenged most of the students to get it done. They were pulling all-nighters. I did six.
Wow.
And I knew, you know, it was one of those things. I mean, there are a long list of things that I'm not good at. I'm not an athlete. I hated baseball. I loved the three-strike rule because it minimized the agony of watching the balls fly past. I could sit down again. But when it came to making things, that I could do. And I found that I could make sculpture. It just was a natural thing for me. So I stayed on at the university, finished a BA within 4 years, went on for a three-year MFA. That was 64. And then decided – I was married by then. And I decided we needed a job teaching sculpture. They're very hard to get. There are very few of them, and there are lots of candidates. So I went to England. We pulled a crazy stunt. My wife and I, we had two trunks, six suitcases, two bicycles, and sailed on a ship, the Hanseatic, over to England in 64 in July and started looking for a teaching job in sculpture in a foreign country for that autumn and got one.
Now, what made you decide to go overseas?
Well, I had a friend that was living there, and he sent me some ads out of the paper that said there seemed to be a few jobs. And I applied to a couple of them, and they wrote back and said, well, you look good, but we can't hire anyone without an interview, and we've already interviewed for these spots. So we thought to ourselves, we better go and just take our chances. And I stayed 3 years, and then we went back later for another year. So it was quite a deal. I mean, that first year, as a full-time college teacher, we made $1,800 for the year. We were forced vegetarians. We could get a chicken once a month. We dug up potatoes from the field across the road and had a lot of potatoes to eat, things like that.
So you went through a starving artist phase.
Real starving artist phase, yeah. That's right. But it was fun. We just about 2 weeks ago had some very dear friends. They had been over here staying with us, and he was my first boss there. So we're still friends with a lot of people from there. It's a very moving and very important part of our lives.
You're listening to Profiles, and my guest is sculptor Tuck Langland. So you just fell in love with sculpture very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just knew that's going to be it. That's going to be my life. You only get a couple of things like that. And about a year before, I had another great thing happen to me that changed my life. And that is I was at a college youth group, and this girl from New York walked in. That's been 44 years of happy marriage now.
And two children.
And that was – yeah, and two children. That was one of those wow moments, you know, like, oh, boy, look at that.
Well, I understand that when Rodin first touched clay, started working with it, he said he felt like he had died and gone to heaven.
Yeah. I had a little different feeling about it, that when you draw somebody – like if I were to draw a picture of you now looking at me straight on, I have to lie. I have to take a flat sheet of paper and make it look as though your nose, for example, sticks out from it. But it's all an illusion. So with clay, you just step off to the side, look at how far the nose sticks out and make it happen. It was like taking a math test with the answers in front of you, to me. It was easier than drawing. It was great. Or let me just say one thing that the great French horn player, was it not Dennis Brain, the other one, he had an article one time called Something I Could Do, in which he said he grew up in a family of musicians, organists and pianists and violinists. He couldn't do any of that. But he picked up the French horn and it was easy for him. And he said, now that I've become the greatest French horn player in the world, I find it a great deal more difficult.
What do you think he meant by that?
It means that you raise your standards. You keep your standards constantly a little ahead of your ability. I've always said that you can achieve success in this world by just lowering your standards to somewhat below your achievement and you're successful. But I think the ones that actually get somewhere, it's a little bit like that carrot dangling from a stick in front of you, that you always are seeking a little higher level. So I'm always slightly failing.
Now, you designed the Herman B. Wells statue that stands in the plaza adjacent to Dunn Woods. How did you get the idea for the design of that piece?
Well, there was a committee put together here, headed by a gentleman. And they needed to find a sculptor. They first went to a large and rather prominent gallery in Loveland, Colorado, which is full of sculptors. And the gallery there, I was an artist in that gallery at that time. And the gallery said, well, you've got an artist right on your own university that could do the job. They said. So then they went to New York to the National Sculpture Society, and the Sculpture Society, well, you've got an artist right on your own university that can do the job. So then they decided to call me up to see whether I'd be interested. And it's kind of funny because, you know, we've all heard this thing about you don't hire the local artists. You know, you get the big names from elsewhere. And I've always said that in the 16th century in Florence, Michelangelo was a local artist. So was Leonardo da Vinci. So they contacted me and we arranged a contract, etc. And then what I had to do was a bit of research. And I came down to Bloomington on several occasions and I remember specifically the meeting where the committee sat around. Now, this committee was people that knew Herman Wells. And they said, we want him sitting on a bench. And there was a couch in the room. So I got up and plopped myself down on one end of the couch and crossed my legs. And they said, no, no, no. First of all, Herman Wells never sat at the end of a couch. He would sit in the middle. Oh. And he never crossed his legs.
Did they say why he would only sit in the middle of a couch?
There were a lot of things about Herman Wells that I think were never answered. I don't know why. And I said, well, what if we move him just a little off center so we've got some room for someone to sit next to him? They said, well, that'd be all right. Then I went to the university archives, put on the white gloves and go through all the photos and picked out, 15 or 20 that I thought were suitable. You have to try to get them of the right age. You don't want him as a very young man and you don't want him as a very old man. You want him at about the peak of his powers, which have been 60 to 65, something like that. And you want to get views, as you can see. And once I had those, then I went to work and I created a 1/3 scale model out of clay, just build it up out of clay. And a third scale is 18 inches tall because he is 54 inches tall to the ground to the top of his head because he's sitting down. He's actually 10% larger than life size. And once that was approved, then we went ahead and enlarged him. And that's – it's a big complicated process. I don't know if you want to hear all that, but I'll give you a very quick little idea. Imagine a smaller sculpture at one-third size sitting on a board. And on that board, I drew a grid of lines 1 centimeter apart. And you can number the lines one way, one through whatever, and you can letter them the other way. So you can say H8 or C9 or whatever, and you can identify a particular spot on that board. Then when I make the big one, I take a bigger, much bigger board, three times larger, and I might make a grid 3 centimeters apart. If I want to find out exactly where a knee is, for example, I find out which letter line it lies over, which number line it lies over, find that same spot on the big board and measure up to the knee on the little one and measure three times as high on the big one, and bingo, there is the precise point of the knee in space. Hmm. And you just start taking a lot of those measurements, and pretty soon there he is. Then you add clay and build it up, and that's how you do it.
You wrote in your book, Practical Sculpture, that communication is probably the most important function of art. That's a quote. What were you trying to communicate with the well sculpture?
It was actually a fairly simple thing. They wanted, and I agreed with this, they wanted him to be there still. He had a habit of coming out of his office during class changing, talk to students, sit down perhaps in the sun or whatever, and just be there. And they said, let's have him there again. So that's the first level, and I suppose a secondary level would be to give some impression of the good will and good humor of the man, his generosity and so on. It's a twinkle in his eye, that sort of thing.
That definitely comes across, the jollity and the friendliness.
When we were having the piece finished up in the foundry, the bronze being finished, I noticed that as foundry workers would walk past it, they'd smile. And I stopped and asked them, why do you smile when you walk past? And the fellow said, well, I don't really know, but he makes me feel happy. And I thought, well, I think that's it. I got it. Because he kind of does.
There's an interesting gesture on the Wells sculpture. His right hand is extended, and it's kind of mysterious. You don't really know what he's doing.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that, first of all, he would come out of his office wearing a hat. And then there was no bench at that spot, but had there been a bench at that spot, I'm sure he would have sat on it. But the hat would shade his eyes. So the first thing I wanted to do was get rid of the hat. But he always wore a hat. So you'll notice he's holding his hat down on the bench in his left hand. Why? Well, it's a blustery day. It's likely to blow off. And you can tell that by his tie being flipped over. Now, a student would come by and he'd shake hands with them. He's just simply shaking hands. But most people shake hands with a thumb pointing up. If I shake hands with you, my thumb's pointing up, your thumb's pointing up, our hands are in identical positions, we clap them together, we have a little squeeze, one pump or so, and we're done. And you don't notice it. You don't think about shaking hands much because we do it all the time. You only notice it when it's different, like if a person has a limp fist or if they decide to be the knuckle crusher or possibly they decide to hold your hand for a long, long time. And you say, I think we're moving into a relationship of somewhat redundant intimacy here. If you don't mind, I have my hand back. Well, what Herman did is he put his hand horizontal, with his thumb pointing to the left. And you have to shake hands with him by coming in underneath him with your thumb pointing to your right and palm up. He's palmed down, and that's how he shook hands. So that's all he's doing. That's all it is, except that Miles Brand said when we unveiled him, let's make a university tradition that you shake his hand for luck during exams. And you'll notice it's pretty shiny. I don't know if exam scores have gone up. I don't know that shaking the hand of a bronze sculpture can alter the performance of a student, but maybe it can. I don't know. Oh, and I'll tell you one other fun thing. We did his shoes. We measured his shoes. I met him before he had passed away. I met him, and one of the things I did was measure his shoes to get them the right size. Then we increased that by 10%, and we modeled the shoes and did the laces very carefully. They're all done in clay. Those are actual clay modeled laces and cast into bronze. They're not real shoes. And when we unveiled him, you know, the last many years of his life, he lived on campus, and he had a number of young male students who would care for him. It'd be one of their jobs. And one came up to me and said, yes, it was my job to tie his shoes. And he was very particular about how his shoes were tied. And if they weren't tied just right, he'd make me redo them. And I got this little balloon over my head, like a cartoon balloon, saying, uh-oh. So with some trepidation, I said, how did we do on the shoes? He said, you got them just right. They're perfect. We just made shoelaces.
So you do a lot of research, mm-hmm, and observation from life. And you try to get the details just right.
Yeah, the details and even more importantly, the overall feel, the overall bulk, mass, silhouette, that gesture. There's a gesture of your head that people may not think about. But just as a quick example, the humble nun versus the drill sergeant, they hold their heads totally differently. And you communicate a great deal by just that.
How so? How would?
Well, a drill sergeant can be rigid and upright, chin forward, so on. The nun would most likely lean forward slightly in humility. A very different feel, very different look. And imagine this. A person walks into the boss's office and he's being chewed out. And just then his cell phone rings. He picks it up. His wife says, honey, we just won $58 billion in the lottery. What's going to happen to his head? It's going to straighten up.
Mm-hmm.
Chin's going to come out. And he's going to say, so long. You see? So that gesture of the head is the start of communication. I look at it this way, that a sculpture is like a person that cannot move and cannot speak but can communicate just the same. And there's a whole infinite range of movements, gestures, etc., that we can communicate with without moving or speaking.
You taught at Indiana University South Bend for about 32 years. What was the sculpture department like when you arrived?
Oh, this is great. I had been teaching at Murray State University in Kentucky, and they had a pretty good sculpture department with a bronze foundry and welders and all that. But I decided I wanted to get back into the northern part of the Midwest where I was from originally.
Where are you from originally?
Minnesota, St. Paul, Minnesota. And so we when my little daughter said, I'm going to be five, we said, let's move. So we found a job. There are only about 2, 3, 4 jobs for sculptors available in the country in any one year.
Really?
And they might have 100 to 200 applicants.
Now, wait, is that the past or is that still now?
Pretty much now, yeah. It's tough. So when I got that job, I didn't ask where. I took it. So I got there and they really didn't have much of a sculpture department. They had 2 old houses with some plaster-encrusted pliers and hammers and a couple of busted-down modeling stands, and that was about it. And I started from there. And within about 4 years, I wangled the university into renting me a large building, industrial building off campus. And we built that thing up over those 32 years to have a full big bronze foundry, all the welding capacity, full wood shop and metalworking stuff and compressor and grinders and sandblasters and all the rest of it. And it was really one of the better ones in the state. And I just did it by nickeling and diming and begging and whining. And I mean, for example, and I can say this now because I'm retired from the university, but, you know, I was chairman of the department for a while, and they give you a budget. And in theory, if you haven't spent that budget by the time the end of the year comes around, next year you'll get that much less. So my plan was to be out of money by September and whining. And my budget went up every year. I come to them in September, I'm out of money. Well, what did you do with it? I bought it to teach the students. Isn't that what I'm supposed to do? I bought things to teach the students. So I kept doing that game and it worked. The university never figured out how to reward thrift. They punish thrift. They reward profligacy.
So you were a good administrator as well as a good artist.
Well, I think the administrators above me hated me.
but you built up the program.
I did it for the program. I embezzled a lot of money by putting money into the drawer. You know, I didn't take money out of the drawer. I put a lot of my own money in. Did things like that, you know. Many teachers do. I think most teachers, sooner or later, are kicking into the program. One of those unknown little contributions that takes place.
You've advised students to, quote, try not to lean on art magazines and the latest fashion in the galleries. Don't try to be like other artists. Try to be yourself. That's the hardest thing of all. What makes that so hard?
Because there's a tremendous pressure from teachers out in the professional world and galleries and so on to be with the latest fashion. And fashion rules so much in our lives. Fashion rules the look of cars. Fashion rules the clothes we wear. Fashion rules the music we hear. Who listens to disco anymore? Nobody listens to disco anymore. Why? Because disco went out of fashion. It was in fashion. Everyone listened. It went out of fashion. Now, Beethoven we still listen to. Why? Because Beethoven has a good deal more substance than disco. But I don't think Beethoven will ever go out of fashion. But this fashion business, I mean, in the 18th century, Michelangelo was considered one of the worst sculptors ever.
Really?
Oh, they thought he was awful. In the 18th century, they thought those big, ugly Gothic cathedrals in France ought to come down, and many were torn down. Oh, yeah, they didn't like them. Huh. They were not fashionable. And you look at a church like Saint-Eustache in Paris, which was built right at the end of the Gothic when the Renaissance style, which is a revival of Greek and Roman, was coming back. And in Saint-Eustache, you've got a Gothic form, and stuck on it are Greek pillars to be fashionable. And the thing about art is that – let me put it this way. Suppose someone you knew and loved took the desperate step of ending their own life and they left behind a suicide note. Would you read that note and correct the grammar? Would you read that note and compare it to other suicide notes and say, I've seen better ones? No. You would read that note to find out what was going through this person's mind and life that caused them to take this step. Well, in a way, every work of art is a sort of suicide note on the grounds that it will go forward in time and we will not. That my works will probably be around in 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years, some of them. And I will only last about another 1,000 or so. So in a way, these are like notes to the future. Is that any place to follow fashion? Or is that maybe the place to be yourself?
Is that one of the values, timelessness, that you try to instill into your students?
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is with students, it's a little like writing a book. First, you've got to learn the language. And you've got to learn how to manipulate language and how to write coherent sentences and paragraphs. Then you can tell a story. But you can't tell a story without those techniques. You can't play Beethoven without learning scales. So the first thing students have to do is learn about armatures and clay and form and anatomy and composition and balance and all those things. And later they can begin to add their own elements to it, their own feelings to it. But at first you're really learning a language, just like any of the arts or almost anything we do. You know, if you want to express yourself in dance, first you have to learn how to dance.
In the nearly 40 years that you've taught sculpture, have you identified certain characteristics among your students that led to them being successful sculptors?
I'm a believer in talent. I think there is such a thing as talent. I know this is a controversial subject, and a lot of teachers think there is no such thing as talent, that you can nurture anyone. But I have on numerous occasions had a group of beginning students come in, and they're all floundering around, and one over there has got it right from the start. I've noticed that little boys of 5 years old, some can catch a ball without being taught. Some cannot catch a ball even if you try to teach them. There is an ability there and a different abilities in different people. My cousin, when he was 5 years old, had the music teachers in St. Paul all abuzz because he was a true prodigy at the piano, and he's had a career as a fabulous pianist all his life. And somebody else can struggle and struggle and struggle and never in 10 years reach the level he reached in 1 year. So I can spot very often when a student has that sense of form, that sense of shape and handling the clay and so on. And then you have to couple that with desire and the ability to work, because all the talent in the world does you no good unless you work at it. We all know that. And so it's really a combination of those three things of talent, desire, and working at it. And usually if you have the desire, you'll work. And if you don't have the desire, well, you often don't work and it fades away. But I've spotted that in many students. I felt that I had that in myself, that I had the talent that I could see after the first day. I was way ahead of those other students. And I've worked at it all my life because that's all I wanted to do. But I've seen that in students over and over. And
an innate ability.
Innate ability. They just get it from the start. And I know that every music teacher has seen students that get it and had students that don't. We call some people tone deaf. I've called some people form dyslexics. You see a form going off at an angle from lower left to upper right, and they'll make it going the other direction.
Hmm.
You know, say, don't you see that? Oh, isn't that like that? No, it's not. So there are some people that don't see form, three-dimensional form. The curious thing is they can live perfectly normal lives. They can recognize people. They can walk down the hallway without banging into doors. They can tie their shoes. But an example was I had an eye doctor in the class one time. And he lectured to us at the blackboard on the 7 different layers within your eyelid with names for every one of them. He didn't know what an eye looked like. He couldn't make an eye out of clay to save his skin. You know, there's a drawing book out called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. I was thinking of calling my second book making sculpture with both sides of your brain. Mm. Because really that's what you do. When you make sculpture, it's partly artistic, it's partly engineering. And that I love. Once my brain is a little fried with the artistic business, I can get into figuring out, you know, how I'm going to bolt the thing down and have to weld this part here and grind that. And that's
one of the things that appeals to you about
sculpture. Very much so. Yeah, very much so. Being a painter, it's too much just the artistic. I want that engineering. And I love to engineer large projects and make them stand up and not fall over. Like Herman Wells, for example. He's affixed to the ground to be, and I don't mean this to be a challenge to anyone, but frat boy proof. They're not going to take that thing away. It could be moved, but not within 20 minutes silently in the middle of the night without campus security hearing them. It won't be moved.
That's a practical consideration.
And I don't think anyone wants to move it. Also, another thing about it is all bronze sculptures, you know, are hollow. Everything bigger than a toy soldier or a banana. They're all cast hollow. They're only 3/16 of an inch thick shell for a number of reasons. Well, he's sitting on that bench and the bench is made of slats and that would leave the bottom open. And likewise, the bottom of the hat would be open. So I've closed both those off because of bees. Bees will come up in there and make nests and come out and sting people. So you sit down next to Herman Wells and zowie. So that's a consideration. I pour water over the sculpture when it's still clay to see if it puddles anywhere because I don't want it to puddle. And I have to make little sort of channels and little angles and things to get the water out of there. These are all considerations. Of course, you can't have anything sticking out that someone's going to poke their eye out with or trip over or anything like that.
So being a sculptor isn't just having an artistic eye. You've got to have a practical way of looking at the finished piece.
You have to be like a designer of furniture or anything else like that and think about the way it's going to be used and potential problems and work them all out ahead of time, yeah.
Let's take a break and listen to one of the two pieces of music that you brought along. What's the first piece?
It's just the most beautiful piece of music ever written by the hand of man is all. It's by Georges Bizet, who wrote Carmen, of course. He wrote one other opera, The Pearl Fishers, which takes place in Sri Lanka or Ceylon, as it was known then. And it's a duet between the tenor and the baritone. The tenor in this recording is Jussi Björling, the fabulous tenor, and Robert Merrill. And it's called Au fond du Temple Saint, which means in front of the Holy Temple. And they are reminiscing about a beautiful woman they once saw in front of a temple. And it just sweeps you away. It's so beautiful.
Is this a piece that you listen to while you're sculpting?
I listen to a lot of opera when I'm sculpting. Very often, if I head out at night for a little night session, I'll take an opera out and I'll say, I'll listen to Tosca. And when Tosca's over, I'll go back in the house. Things like that. I like opera very much. I go to the opera when I can. And here at Bloomington, there is one of the finest opera houses I've ever seen. This opera house is terrific. The furthest back seat is practically in the lap of the performers. It's wonderful.
Okay, let's listen to the music.
Sure.
Music chosen by our guest, sculptor Tuck Langland. Okay, that was the Pearl Fishers duet by Bizet, music chosen by our guest tonight on Profiles, Tuck Langland. Do you know who the performers were?
Jussi Björling was the tenor, and the great Robert Merrill was the baritone. And they were – well, Jussi Björling died in 1960. I was at sea on the New Amsterdam coming home from Europe, my first trip to Europe. I just got back on this last weekend from my 34th, I think it was, trip to Europe. But so this is pre-1960, this recording.
Wow. So you go to Europe a lot.
I do a lot, yeah.
What do you do there?
Well, I visit friends. I look at cathedrals. This last trip I was just having a good vacation in Spain with a couple of friends. And We like to go to the – my wife and I love to go to the Orkney Islands north of Scotland. We've been there 5 times now. Barren, bleak, filled with prehistoric sites all over the place. Just wonderful stuff.
Are you attracted to places with interesting forms? I know sculpture is mostly about forms.
Well, my passion for the French and English Gothic cathedrals is in a way that. I've described those cathedrals as hollow, abstract sculptures designed to reveal the mind of God. The thinking goes that if God is perfect, what on earth is perfect? Well, mathematics and geometry. So these buildings are based on mathematics and geometry. And they're – I mean, when you look at a stone building that's 800 years old where the ceiling is 140 feet overhead, held up there strictly by arches, no steel, and the bosses in the center of the ceiling weigh 2,000 pounds each, and the entire building will flex slightly in the wind. And as I say, it's been there 800 years. You have to kind of whistle lowly and sort of say, my goodness, I'm in a pretty amazing place here. People say, oh, those dark, dusty cathedrals, nonsense. The light streams in them, pours in them. Fabulous places. And then the prehistoric sites, I've always been excited by that. I like history a lot. I mean, I went to France about 2 years ago with a friend of mine, and one of the highlights of the trip was standing in a muddy, plowed field in a slight drizzle, standing exactly where the French knights stood in St. Crispin's Day, October 25th of 1415 at Agincourt, right there. That's great stuff. I've walked on the deer path where Buddha preached his first sermon. These are wonderful places to be. And I'm amazed that there are a lot of people that don't want to travel at all. They're perfectly happy where they are. Not me. I want to see it all.
That reminds me of something that you wrote about in one of your books, how art used to take literary references and references from scripture and put it into paintings and sculpture, for example. And then that went out of fashion. Mm-hmm. But you use a lot of literary references in your or your storytelling references or elements in your sculptures,
I do some.
Don't you?
I do some. An interesting thing was just a week ago I was in the Museum of Fine Arts in Seville in Spain. And you're going through there. The collection begins at around 1300 to 1400. And it is all religion, saints and so on, all religion until you reach about the year 1800. And suddenly that disappears. And you now get landscapes and portraits and still lifes and interiors. There's just this giant sea change. It reminded me of driving north out of Phoenix toward the Grand Canyon. You see these fields of saguaro cactus. All of a sudden they stop. There's just a line where they stop because you're going up. All of a sudden the religious paintings stop right around the beginning of the 19th century. And I've used narrative and anecdote in my art. When I was in graduate school, somebody put up a big sign in the painting studio that said anecdotal art is retrograde. So you're not supposed to do that. And I thought, well, it was good enough for Michelangelo. I guess it'll be good enough for me.
What do they mean by anecdotal art?
Art that tells stories. We used to have a lot of arguments about, or discussions, I should say, about things like, is Norman Rockwell any good? And students would say, well, he's just an illustrator. So I would ask them, what is an illustrator? Oh, you know, you paint pictures of stories for money. I said, yeah, like the Sistine Ceiling. Yeah, he painted pictures of stories for money. That's not the question. The question is it any good? And another question is, does it go beyond the story? Does it tell you something more about life and experience and so on, which the Sistine Ceiling does? So I don't mind putting narrative in. But I would say this, that all works of art, at least all representational works of art, contain two major elements. One is, what is it a picture or a sculpture of? And the other is, how is it done? Nabokov, the great author that wrote Lolita, etc., he was once asked for his advice to a young literary critic, which means what's good literature, which means what's good art. And he said this. He said, first of all, pay attention to the how and not the what. How is it done, not what is it of? He said, but beware of the so what. I painted this barefoot on broken glass. So what? Then the second thing he said was, pay particular attention to the small hairs on the back of your neck. And I think that is just exactly my feeling. So when I say pay attention to the how and not the what, another way to put it would be this. A dog lover would rather have a bad sculpture of a dog than a good sculpture of a cat. Most people rarely get past subject matter. Mm-hmm. They rarely get past the what, and they don't necessarily see the how. And mm-hmm. I think those are important things to remember, that there's nothing particularly important about a large work of art. Some of my all-time favorite works of art are as small as an ordinary piece of paper, mm-hmm. typing paper. And some of the ones I hate the most are huge. I think the earliest piece of art that tells a story is in the Lascaux Caves, and it's maybe 15, 18,000 years old, and there's a bison there that's been disemboweled, and a man lies on the ground with a spear next to him. And it seems to me it's perhaps telling a story that this man attacked this bison and was killed by it, rather than just a general figure of a bison on the wall that could be any animal. I think that one says this is a specific animal at a specific moment during a specific act. That's where anecdotal or storytelling art begins, 15,000, 18,000 years ago. And it hasn't stopped.
Now, you designed a sculpture for a cancer ward or a hospital in Pittsburgh that seems to me to be a narrative sculpture. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, this was the Hillman Cancer Center that was under construction when I was contacted. And it consists of two parts. One large building is pure research and the other is an outpatient center where they actually apply the research. And this sculpture was to go in the center of the drive-through for the outpatient center. It was a difficult space. There's a ceiling over it. There's a couple of big pillars that you have to dodge around. And the real thing that made it difficult is that this is a sculpture to be seen by people who are driving loved ones who are very seriously, perhaps mortally ill, for care. So what I created was six figures. And in the center of this group of figures is a man dressed in old-fashioned clothes, an older man. And on his shoulders is a little girl. And around them there are two men and two women, and they're in dance-like poses, and they're all interconnected by long bronze ribbons twisting and rolling from their hands to make them joined. And when we delivered the piece, the workers, the construction workers were working there, and they were going to help us get these out. And, of course, they're going to have this attitude like, what's this art stuff? When they unloaded the pieces, they realized that they were weighty matters because they're very heavy. So we stood them up, put them in place, and one fellow asked me, what do these represent? Now, this is a man who's a construction worker at the hospital. And I said, they represent the circle of care. When you are in a hospital, it's not just the doctor and the nurse that come in your room that care for you, but there is a web of care that extends out from them through to other doctors, through to the past. Everything a doctor knows comes from something someone before him or her discovered. It extends on the web to perhaps specialists in France or China or any place. It extends through all the other people in the hospital that care for you. For example, the people that cook your meals, the people that wash the floors, that change the beds. And I said to the man, the construction worker, I said, and that includes you. Because if you don't build this hospital, no one gets healed. And you know what? He stood up straighter. Now, the old man in the center with a little girl on his shoulders, he represents all the researchers of the past, going back to Stone Age medicine women. And the little girl represents somebody out there who may be a 10-year-old little girl now or a little boy who in another 25 years may be the key breakthrough in, for example, cancer research. And we don't know who that person is, but they're all linked together. That's how we work as humanity. We do it together. There's no doctor in the world that works on their own, no hospital that works alone. And that's what that showed. And it's a kind of a jolly piece. They're kind of dancing and the ribbons are there, but there's that meaning behind it.
All right. The reporter for the newspaper that picture was printed described it as being jubilant.
Would you suggest we put flowers in a patient's room? Sure, because it's beauty. It's an affirmation of life. Mm-hmm. So the jubilance of it is, I think, appropriate there. That, you know, let's not have a row of weeping mourners. That would be pretty rugged. But then the meaning behind it, the sort of linking together of all these different people, I think gives it a little substance once that's explained.
Well, that's a very different experience regarding that sculpture than one would have, say, for a work of abstract art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, abstract art has, of course, taken over in the 20th century and continues strongly today. And a great number of public monuments are abstract, and they have a place, and they certainly work in many, many cases. If you have a very modern building, for example, all steel and glass, it seems a little odd to put a bronze figure in front of it. Mm-hmm. And a large abstract work is often much more appropriate. On the other hand, if a community wants to memorialize, let's say, fallen firefighters, They don't want I-beams. They want firefighters. So there's room on our in our world for both. There's plenty of room for both. And I've always been annoyed at people that would just as soon open the door to a new artistic experience but close the old one behind them and say you can't go back. Currently, I'm doing sculptures that are imitative of ancient Greek sculpture. I don't know why, but I want to. And one of the most important rules of contemporary art is that there are no rules. That's the big one. There are no rules.
And do you subscribe to that?
Yeah. Yeah, I subscribe to that. That's part of what we said earlier, of do what you feel, do what you believe in, rather than following fashion.
Now that you're no longer teaching at IU South Bend, how do you spend the bulk of your time?
I said to someone the other day, they asked me, are you busy? And I said, I'd have to slow down to be busy. I am at it night and day all the time. I have an assistant that helps me a great deal. I've got about 5 commissions underway right now and about another 4 or 5 waiting in the wings, including a 40-foot-long bridge that I'm going to make railings and panels for. So it's just one after another. They seem to be coming in faster than ever. As I complete a commission, I seem to get 2 more. So basically, I'm now doing what I spent all my college years being trained to do. For the first time in my life, I get to be a full-time real sculptor. All the rest of the time, I was a teacher that made sculpture. And I could say that when I began teaching, I was spending probably 80% of my time and effort teaching and 20% making sculpture. And if you drew a graph, you'd see that over the years, that ratio would slowly change. Till my last few years of teaching, while not neglecting classes, because I knew what I was doing, I could be more efficient, I would spend 20% of my thinking effort on the classes and 80% making sculpture. And then I just simply nipped off that last bit of teaching and went into full-time sculpture, and that's where I'm really happy. I really like it. It means that I can do things like trot off to Spain in the middle of April when school's still on, things like that. In fact, the first fall when I was retired, when my colleagues were going back to teaching, I went to France for a while. But mostly it's just making art.
What are the prospects like, the career prospects like for a young sculptor these days? And what kind of career advice did you give to your students?
Well, the prospects are very good. Many times people say, parents might say, oh, don't go into art. You can't make a living. I know people that are making very good livings at sculpture, very good living. So the thing to do is hone your craft, be good, you know, work at it. Decide on some kind of a niche. I mean, I know people that just do animals. I know people that just do nostalgic Western things, things like that.
You've written that sculptors use some of the same forms used in poetry and music.
Mm-hmm. Pieces of music don't just kind of ramble along. They usually have a structure. A common structure is a sonata allegro form in which, put in a nutshell, you introduce a melody, then you introduce a second, different melody, then you play with those on top of each other, around each other, back and forth and so on. Then you kind of restate them at the end and there's your piece. And sculptures can do that. For example, that piece in Pittsburgh uses figures. That's like your first melody. And it uses all those ribbons. That's like a second melody. And you're putting together two very different things. I've always felt that putting together two different things is a challenge but enriches what's happening rather than just one thing. You know, you have contrast, 2 or 3 or 4. I mean, and there are other musical forms like fugues where you introduce a tune and then you introduce it again but in a different key where the first tune continues to play and so on. There are variations on themes which you can do. You can have a series of sculptures that are variations on the first one. And there are all sorts of things. I mean, a famous example of that is the famous Matisse backs where he did 4 backs, 1, 2, 3, 4. And each one is different than the previous one, and yet you can tell it's the same basic idea. That would be a variation on a theme. So those forms work very well, and you have similar forms in poetry. And I think the addition of a clear and logical form to a work of art lends it strength and character rather than a totally improvisational, free-form style. Most works of art, in fact, have that. In fact, you take a great romantic work of art like the Liberty at the Barricades by Delacroix, in which you've got a figure of liberty holding a tricolor flag, charging the barricades during the Revolution of 1834, I think it was. Very romantic piece, full of smoke, dust, and dirt and everything, all based very rigidly on a beautiful triangle. He started that canvas by drawing a big triangle, which is the most stable of forms, and added everything around that. That kind of thing can, I think, enhance a work greatly.
In one of your books, you actually mentioned various musical forms and then discussed sculptures that corresponded to those forms. I think you even mentioned Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star as being a certain kind of form.
Yeah. I can't remember exactly what I said then because that was written about 25 years ago.
I think you compared that to a cylinder because it was so simple.
Yeah, it's that sort of idea that some kind of clearly understood underlying structure helps us to see the work. That when you watch a ballet, for example, it's not just a bunch of people milling around on the stage, but you'll get circles, squares, lines, angles, and you can see those patterns. But that kind of structure to a work, I think, is essential.
Are there any sculptors that have influenced you in particular from the past or contemporary sculptors?
Oh, heavens. So many. So many. I mean, I could start with, for example, the Egyptians. They've had a big impact on me. Greek sculpture has a huge impact on me. Interestingly enough, Roman, not much, because Roman is not so much concerned with art as it is with politics, quite honestly. Medieval sculpture hasn't had much of an impact, partly because it's all masses of cloth. But the medieval sculpture of India, I've been to India a couple of times, and the sculptures at a place called Khajuraho are figures that are sensual, human, and yet very, very simplified, almost geometric. And that's had a huge impact on my work, probably more than any other. But others as well, Henry Moore and Giacomo Manzu and many other sculptures. Big impact, yeah. And I look at sculpture all the time. And you know how it is. You go and look at a sculpture and you think, that's it. That's what I want to do. And then the next one you see, you go, oh, that's it. Then you have to say, stop it now. Be yourself. I'll close with this, I think. I'm often asked to make a statement, an artist statement about my work. And I've kind of honed it down to this one. I would like my work to be discovered by archaeologists 3,000 years from now. And when it is dug up and dusted off and put perhaps in a museum, I'd like three things to happen. One, I'd like them to know it's a work of art. Number two, I'd like them to have no idea when it was created. I'd like to step right outside the parade of fashion and make it timeless in that sense. And number three, when they dig it up, I want their hearts to beat faster.
My guest tonight has been sculptor, professor, and author Tuck Langland. And you can see some of Mr. Langland's work on the web. If you do a search for Tuck Langland, there are various pictures. Do you want to tell us?
There's one other piece on the IU campus, and that's in the Student Union. It's called Maasai Mother. It's a bust of a Maasai African woman on a pedestal, life-size bust with a lot of beads on, taken from photographs that I took from her live in front of Mount Kilimanjaro. And that's another piece on the campus that people can see in the Union. They have to look for it, but they'll find it.
And you can hear this program in the Profiles archive on the WFIU website by visiting WFIU.org and clicking on Programs and then Profiles. We're going to go out on another piece of music chosen by my guest, Tuck Langland. This is a piece by Philip Glass. It's from the CD called Song from Liquid Days, and it's titled Open the Kingdom. I'm Adam Schwartz. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week for another edition of Profiles. The program you just heard was recorded in May of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.